Okay, and if I get too soft, raise your hands. Okay, I hate people not here. Troublous times and troublesome people. Radicalism and unrest in 18th and 19th century Dunfermline. This talk is about radical Dunfermline. Radicalism originally meant going back to the roots of a thing, but has come to mean a movement to change. Dunfermline came to be known as a radical town, partly because the weavers, who formed such a large section of the workforce, were in the forefront of movements for religious and political reform. At one time, Dunfermline even had its own radical ale. Did you know that, George? Often troublesome people of the time, Dunfermline has had its fair share, often whole families of them. Folk who had no particular religious or political acts to grind, but would not obey the law or answer the curb sessions or the civic authorities. Occasionally, vagabonds and thieves, like the witches of earlier times, were hung on the gibbet set up at the witch stone on the way to town hall. Many people came to know about the naturally, drunkenness, shameless of trouble, fornication, or even worse, adultery, sometimes not for the first time. Occasionally the sinner was an elder or a local laird, and in the 1730s, two members of the fourth family of Pigeonfree were accused of fathering children on local girls. Regardless of rank, most sinners had to face the ordeal of a public reprimand on the black stool of repentance. And here we have one. There's the sinner up in the dock. You can see his shame-faced parents sitting down there, and there's the cause of all the problems, the girl with the baby. And that was what it was like, coming to Paul, and then the minister is haranguing him. We think that was by David Allen, and we see it's in the Dunfermline church, but it's not the Abbey. Anyway, that was the school of repentance. Open above these everyday problems, the disturbance is brought about by religious and political controversy, when Dunfermline was above, and people were forced to choose between opposing factions. Because the time is short, the full story of the upheavals in church life will have to be told elsewhere. Suffice to say that major change came in the 1730s and 40s, with the secession movement led by Ralph Erskine, the relief movement of Thomas Gillespie, and the building of large barn-like churches for their followers. And you saw the picture, first of all, and that's typical. There's Ralph Erskine in front of his barn-like church. After he goes away from the church, the school really is like another story. It's almost too much to tell. These changes set in motion about 150 years of breaking away, forming new congregations, and the often acrimonious splitting into smaller groups. Until 1740, Dunfermline had one church, the Abbey. In 1844, an ecclesiastical census lists 14 different denominations in some 18 places of worship. These include the three churches set up following the Great Disruption of 1843, which was caused by the old and thorny problem of the intrusion by the state and the aristocracy into affairs deemed to belong to the church or to individual souls. If all this religious controversy has done anything to the people of Dunfermline, it's given them a sense of their own power, the ability to think for themselves, and skill in organisation. At times, the paths of church and political life crossed. For example, at the Abbey during the election of 1774, there were heated exchanges between the Reverend James Thompson, a former army chaplain, and members of the Scotland family. Thompson preached to Ephesians, "Wherefore, putting away lying, speak ye truly, each one with his neighbour, for we are members one with another," and pointed his finger at Robert Scotland, accusing him of duplicity during the election. Robert Scotland called Thompson an old military blunderbuss, and challenged him to inform his congregation what bribe he had got to propagate such false and furious calumnies from the pulpit. I don't think the congregation will set you that particular point. This leads on to political controversy and unrest. In the 1790s, the time of the French Revolution and wars with France, many radical thinkers in Scotland emphasized with the French ideals. The radical works of Thomas Paine, Common Sense, The Rights of Man, The Age of Reason, and Agrarian Justice were widely read. Paine defended the revolution in America and France, criticized monarchies and European social institutions, and stressed the need for representative government, with taxes on wealth to pay for a social program for the poor. He also advocated freedom of thought and criticized organized religions, saying, "My own mind is my own church." Paine also emphasized that land ownership separates the majority of people from their rightful natural inheritance and means of independent survival. Paine escaped to France before he could be sentenced for seditious libel. And this is, that's Thomas Paine, who's practically most famous book. And it was said that Napoleon slept with that book under his pillow. And this is a cartoon of the time, and it shows Thomas Paine, and it says fashion before ease. And it's Thomas Paine trying to get the British Constitution to fit his ideas. And up on the thing, you can look down, it says Thomas Paine, day maker for sexes. And you can see it's got the red hat of liberty. It's a wonderful cartoon. Thomas Paine's writing is relatively into the center of the radical society of the history. And in 1791, a group called the Friends of the People was launched in Scotland in close association with the Reform Society of London. The membership was said to be made up of shopkeepers and artisans, like weavers and other craftsmen. At the inaugural meeting in 1791 in Edinburgh, attended by delegates from all over Scotland, it was proposed that a permanent society be formed to obtain a wider franchise and to bring back our constitution to its original purity, the old meaning of the word radical. As well as seeking the actual representation of the people, the meeting resolved to pursue the most legal and constitutional means for regulating the internal government of the boroughs by destroying the present pernicious system. And there were also increasing expressions of support for the French Revolution and demands for the end of the wars with France. The Friends of the People held three general conventions between December 1792 and October 1793, each one resulting in the arrest of leading figures in the movement, while a proclamation against seditious publications was issued by Henry Dunbar, Secretary of State for Scotland. The Secretary of the Friends of the People was William Stirling, who owned Strathruggy, a farm near Lochemy. Stirling was no firebrand, but an agriculturalist who was once trained as a minister in the Burger Church. One authority claims that finding out more about William Stirling would help uncover the ideological underpinnings of Scottish radicalism, and regards him as occupying an interesting juncture between religion, Enlightenment thought, and political and popular radicalism. A branch of the Friends of the People was set up in Dunfermline, and there's a still exists between William Stirling, writing from Edinburgh, and the local members. One of them, Adam Dixon, known as Cato after the Roman statesman, ran a private school in Dunfermline and begged Stirling not to reveal his name, because of his business. The unfair distribution of land in Scotland may also have been an issue to local reformers, and it is said that the Friends of the People in Dunfermline had the Piddenfleet estate and other land nicely divided up as small farms for the members. I would just say that Stirling was arrested and sent to transportation to New South Wales, and he started a little farm of New Strathruggy there. That he just harvested his, for the first time when he died. And Governor Hunter of New South Wales called him a very quiet, decent, and industrious man. So there was no firebrand, and the friends of the people really wanted reform by peaceful means. In 1796, Dunfermline Town Council resolved that the town house be refused to weavers for meetings, as they had lately formed unlawful combinations, and this probably referred to numbers of them being followers of the Friends of the People, or the United Scotsmen. The United Scotsmen, which had links with the United Irishmen, was active in the later 1790s. They seemed to be more extreme and more violent than the Friends of the People, and attracted supporters of all classes. They had a strong streak of republicanism, and were opposed to taxes and all distinction of rank and religion, scoffing at ministers and their congregations. The members were bound by secret oaths, and agents came from Glasgow to form societies in Dunfermline and other towns, and to communicate intelligence about the organisation and about the war, rejoicing at French victory. The government recognised that one of the aims of the United Scotland was to replace the British monarchy with a republic. The scandalous pamphlets being circulated made clear their dislike of the royal family. One of them concerned in the Prince of Wales had the title John Bull Starving to Pay the Debts of the Royal Prodigal. Many of the pamphlets were the work of George Newman, the Dungeon Worker, who was inserted in the Queen's Servant on the 10th of the In September 1798, two Dunfermline weavers, David Black and James Patterson, who were among the leaders of the movement, were accused of sedition for being members of the United Scotsmen, and under an Act of Parliament of George III, of having administered unlawful oaths or engagements. Black did not appear for the trial in Perth and was outlawed, but the jury found Patterson guilty of sedition, although the second charge of unlawful oaths was not proven. He was sentenced to be transported for 5 years to such a place beyond the seas as His Majesty, with the advice of the Privy Council, should appoint. George Mealmaker was tried in Edinburgh and transported to Botany Bay, where he died some years later. I think I'll move on to talk about the reform movement. Reform within the Scottish Brothers is much overdue. Dunfermline, for example, experienced an increase in population from 5,000 in 1791 to 10,500 in 1800. When it came to electing a member of Parliament, this was done by a delegate elected from the council, usually the province. Further, as part of the Stirling boroughs, Dunfermline shared its MP with Stirling and three other parishes, Inverkeithing, Curross, and Queensbury. The corruption of the elections was horrendous. Bribery in the way of money and huge dinners was commonplace. But in June 1796 came something worse. One of the candidates, Sir John Henderson of Fordell, paid his colliers to rampage through the town, armed with bludgeons, threatening opponents and raising their windows, while a few of his cronies actually kidnapped Provost John Moody and five other members of council at gunpoint and imprisoned them in the black hole of Inverkeithing. This was to prevent the Provost being elected delegate and voting for the favourite, John Cochrane of Curross. The Provost escaped and the plan was thwarted, but it led the council to report in their meeting their disgust at Sir John's actions, which had been so very inconsistent with the liberty of the subject and the time of election. Such corruption was one of the reasons behind the demand for reform. In February 1817, a great reform meeting, attended by about 800 people, was held at Antiburger Bray, which was a steep bank at the rear of Chalmers Street United Presbyterian Church, the old site for Antiburger tent preaching. In 1818, the reform was attacked by the well-worried Scotland. 28, with a population of 379,360, had declared in favour of borough reform. 38 boroughs, with a population of 107,235, had not yet given their opinion. for the Sterling boroughs, Dunfermline was among those for reform. The 1830s and 1840s were curious decades in some ways. On the one hand, these were troublous times of riots, strikes, and political unrest. On the other hand, the church, council, and the majority of Dunfermline people appeared loyal to the royal family, celebrating each accession, each birthday, and each visit to Scotland, and sending loyal messages to London on the occasion of illness, death, and popular unrest. In 1831, the Provost called a meeting of his inhabitants to discuss the propriety of addressing His Majesty and the ministers in the present important crisis. This probably referred to the riots which followed the House of Lords' rejection of the Second Reform Bill. Eventually, a Reform Act for Scotland was passed in 1832, and Dunfermline celebrated with parties everywhere and with tables laden with food and drink all over the town. In 1833, George Birrell, the first Bailey of the Council, chaired the inaugural electoral meeting for the Reform Parliament. Although the Reform Act had its shortcomings, its passage meant that Scotland had made a start on true parliamentary democracy for the first time since the Union. Only 8 members of Parliament were added to the Scottish borough, but the £10 occupier franchise introduced by the Act meant that about 1 in 8 men now became elected. In Scotland, the number of electors in a population of over 2 million rose from less than 5,000 to over 65,000. In Dunfermline, the electorate was given as 493 in a population of town and suburbs of some 12,000, about a third of whom would be adult males. As you can see from the electoral list at the time, men with a variety of occupations were represented.
Leaders visited Dunfermline,
And in 1838, John Collins of Birmingham spoke on the great subject at the Old Traitor Hall in Montague Street. In the summer of 1842, the Chartists organized a universal strike, which coincided with agitation among the Dunfermline leaders at a threatened reduction in wages. On Monday, August 8, 1842, a meeting at the Thames attracted a large crowd of men, women, and children. And at 8 in the evening, a crowd gathered again, this time with flags flying, and the Netherton Waits, the drum set that belonged to the tent of the people, brought into action. A crowd of 500 followed the drum to the east end of the High Street, where they broke the windows of Walter Watson's warehouse. The town officers protecting the property were driven off, and the factory to the rear was also set on fire. Robert Morris, Baby Drummond, and Mr. James Inglis, a notice of the former himself, tried to quell the crowd, but were driven off, as Mr. Thomas Morris and another reformer was tried to please the spies. The crowd had now got quite out of hand and plundered the shop of John Scotland, Mr. Watson's partner. Meanwhile, the sheriff had called in the constables, and they soon scattered the crowd with their batons. At the town house, the constables were put on standby, and the next day the magistrate issued a proclamation threatening most severe measures if there was any further disturbance. The leaders met on Friday and managed to reach a compromise with the manufacturers. However, on another front, trouble was just beginning. At Townhill Colliery, an attempt was made to cut the ropes that secured the coal wagons, but this was frustrated by the watchman, who was badly injured. Shortly afterwards, constables were sent out to Crossgate, where a bakery had been plundered, and they apprehended the man who was said to be responsible for the Townhill incident. At Hall Beak, the women, and the women were very part of these demonstrations, the women rose en masse, stoned the constables, and rescued the prisoner. Soldiers from the Dragoons and the 42nd Regiment marched to Albany, secured the prisoner, and escorted him to the town house. On the 23rd of August, a meeting of miners and others decided to go on strike, and this was followed during September and October by strikes of miners all over the country. The Kelty miners were out for 2 months, as well as miners working the Elgin, Wellwood, and Calvin Beach Coal. Tenders were at tinderbox levels. On October the 16th, 1842, a gang attacked 2 young soldiers, and the riot that followed was only quelled when Sheriff Monteith came on the scene and led the riot. Resentment simmered on, and within a few years, trouble broke out again. At the beginning of November 1845, there were further riots about low wages. A crowd of more than 1,000 gathered and attacked the homes of Thomas Alexander and Abby Parkface and James Alexander at Darmule and their warehouses in Canmore Street. Provost One was badly beaten trying to quell the riot, and if it was too much for the local police, the sheriff advised sending to Edinburgh for the military. Eventually, the 3 ringleaders were captured, and on November the 6th, John Coote, John Gibson, and William Smith were tried at the High Court in Edinburgh. In his summing up, the judge pointed out that workmen could now combine to negotiate on increases in wages or other objects, but were prohibited from using violence against people or property. He sentenced Coote and Smith to 12 months imprisonment, and Gibson to 7 years transportation to a colony, where it was hoped he would find a respectable livelihood. The actions of the peace, through the people, through their churches, local politics, and reforming organizations contributed to change, which eventually came about by peaceful means. In Britain, there was to be no revolution like those all over Europe in 1848. At the height of the Chartist strike, a shopkeeper, shutting up his shop, was heard to mutter, "They shackles may come off to regain the charter, the held charter, and making but the charter." But it was not to be in his lifetime. The movement had fizzled out by the 1850s, but after long years, the 6 points of the charter had gradually come about. Reforming Acts of 1867, 1884, and 1918 gave the vote, initially to adult men, and finally in 1928 to all men and women over 21. It has been a long fight in which the people of Dunfermline have more than made their part.